Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The next few weeks could be a pivotal time in Congress as members of the House and Senate consider some key parts of President Biden's domestic agenda. One bill allocates roughly $1 trillion for a traditional infrastructure package. It includes new money to repair roads and bridges, upgrade water treatment plants, and expand access to broadband services. A second bill spends around $3.5 trillion to expand Medicare services, create universal pre-kindergarten programs, and it also includes measures to address climate change. And there's a voting rights bill. There's some question if these bills can be approved without ending the filibuster in the Senate. Senator Patrick Leahy serves as the president pro tem of the Senate. He's also the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Leahy says he supports efforts to carve out some exemptions for the filibuster, but he acknowledges that taking this action could come back to haunt the Democrats if and when the Republicans regain control of the Senate.
You come to vote yes or no, and they should have the courage to vote on these issues. We shouldn't even have to have the question of filibuster. If they're opposed to something, then vote against it. Certainly, a woman's right to choose, they would have repealed that had we not had the filibuster. So it's a double-edged sword.
What's the future for these proposals? Will Senate Democratic leaders be able to convince all 50 members to support these bills, even if it requires a temporary end of the filibuster process? These are some of the questions we have today for someone who is right in the middle of these discussions in the Senate, and that is Senator Patrick Leahy. Senator, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be with you.
Senator, as we mentioned in the introduction, there are two different infrastructure bills, a smaller one that might be considered the traditional physical infrastructure bill, a larger one that has been referred to as a social and environmental bill. Let's start with the physical bill, the smaller of those two, something in the neighborhood of $1 trillion. It looks like this bill has very strong Democratic support. It might get some support of Republican members. What's the outlook for this bill at this time?
Well, I think it'd be very hard for somebody to say, I'm going to vote against this, and then go home and say, oh, isn't it wonderful they're finally fixing that bridge, that water system, whatever. And somebody's going to say, well, did you support that? I think it's a wonderful idea. Did you vote for that? No, I didn't. No. Let's stand up and vote. This is spread over a number of years, how it's going to be done. But taking Vermont, we have 2,700 bridges. We got 570 miles of freight railroad. We have 14,000 miles of public road. And you know, a lot of that really needs to be fixed. We have 66 bridges, over 660 miles of highway that are in poor condition. The independent engineering groups have said that they'll get at best a C. I remember after Hurricane Irene, the day after that, I was going around the state in a helicopter with the governor and the adjutant general. We were looking at all the damage done to Vermont, and it was as a lifelong Vermonter, I was actually in tears seeing some of it. Now, we've started to repair some of that, but we have so far to go. This is something we need. I mean, for once we're saying, let's take care of some things here in the United States. Let's do things that can't be done otherwise. Oh, and by the way, not only will we leave something for the next generation, but we'll create a whole lot of new jobs, well-paying jobs, in the meantime.
Senator, I've been reading that in the last couple of days that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is indicating he might support this bill. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think he understands that his state needs these needs this work also. And I don't think that he really thinks he can get away with going home and saying, oh, I oppose Biden on this. Oh, by the way, isn't it wonderful that we're finally repairing the water system in this city that's so much in need of repair? He can't get away with it. I mean, I know that he said when President Obama was elected, his number one goal was to make him a one-term president, work against him. That's wrong. Unfortunately, President Obama was reelected. He started off somewhat similar with President Biden, but I think he's changing. And I think you're seeing the a difference, both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. For one thing, a lot of them know President Biden. He came and spoke to us a couple of days ago at our policy luncheon in the Mansfield room. He and I were talking about the fact that both of us had the privilege of serving with Mike Mansfield. And we were thinking that was a time when Republicans and Democrats would work together as they should. I pointed out what we've done in Vermont with COVID, when Republicans and Democrats will come together. I've been at COVID things in Vermont. I've had the Republican Governor Phil Scott, the Democratic Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray standing there. And we're all saying the same thing because it was best for the state. And that's the way it works. In fact, I was pleased that the president asked Governor Scott to be part of his advisory group of governors, a bipartisan advisory group. The country suffers if we can't sit down and say, let's actually work these things out. But you also suffers if a leader of either party says, we will say no to whatever comes up on the other side.
Senator, maybe you could straighten something out for me. I am confused about one thing. You have the smaller physical infrastructure bill and then the larger one that deals with a host of Medicare issues and child care and elder care and climate change. President Biden has said that he's not going to sign one without the other. So are these two bills linked together? Are you willing to sacrifice the physical, smaller infrastructure bill if you can't get the larger one passed?
I'm hoping we can get both. There's some confusion on just what might be done there. I think, in fact, one of the reasons I'm here this weekend, our appropriations staff has been working very hard on the different aspects of both bills. And I've been, of course, making sure that Vermont is covered in that, as are other states. And I think if one passes, the other will pass. I really do. They are different in what they do. One is infrastructure itself, but the other goes into everything from how our schools open up and how we handle health care and all these other aspects that, again, spread over years. But when you go and you ask the American people and you do polling, every single aspect of it gets overwhelming suspect. I think Americans, after coming out of COVID, realizing that the country a year or so ago did not react quickly enough on COVID, how much it hurt us, that we have to have steps taken to make sure we're prepared to whatever emergency comes up again. Will there be another COVID? Well, we're already seeing a virulent strain coming. Let's be prepared so we can move very, very quickly. Otherwise, how can members of Congress, either party, say to the next generation, well, we took care of ourselves, we did nothing for you?
I understand that you'd like to see them both pass and that you hope that they both will pass, but I guess Are they linked together? Do you think if one passes and the other doesn't, that that jeopardizes the first one?
Well, that's a decision the president's going to have to make, which ones he's going to sign, or if he's going to sign one and the other one does not pass. I would hope they both pass. I would hope that if only one passes, that the president signs that. I would much prefer two, because I think you can do a short-term fix, but we have long-term fixes in this country. We have to do this for the next generation. And look at what we're facing around the world. Look at a country like China that is trying to become the predominant power in the world, something we've always taken for granted the United States was. We want to come back to that. That doesn't mean just military power by any means. It means economic power, academic power. We want to be the country where students from other countries want to come to learn and to work with our scientists, our medical people, and all to create jobs for the next generation.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Nancy, who is calling from Morrisville. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. My question was actually away from Washington, but Cuba, which I believe the senator has a lot of interest in. And I wondered if you thought there was any chance that we could lift some of these really draconian sanctions that we have against Cuba, which, you know, is just as a neighboring country just seems to me somewhat inappropriate.
No, I'll be glad to go into that. But just a moment before I do, in our trips back home, since COVID started lifting, one of the places Marcel and I went to was Morrisville. And she's, of course, a registered nurse. And we met with the nurses at the Morrisville Hospital and the volunteers who were at the Veterans Center. And they were doing the COVID shots. It was so inspirational to see the whole community coming together and, to see Morrisville doing that. Now, on your question, we have different administrations that try different kinds of sometimes draconian measures against Cuba, expecting them to change. Of course, it did nothing at all. It only hurt the Cuban people. And the Cuban leaders, if they had problems in supplies of food or electricity or anything else, they could say, well, we could do so much better, but it's the fault of the United States. Now, President Obama started lifting that. I had gone down there many times. Both Marcel and I had. We had worked with young people who were starting up their businesses, hospital facilities and others. It was improving. And the last administration decided that, I don't know if they thought Cuba, a small country like that, was a threat to the United States, and they started clamping down. All that did was to strengthen the hands of the communist leaders and hurt the Cuban people. The demonstrations you're seeing in the streets of Cuba, and I've walked back and forth on a number of those streets and talked to the people there. It's a frustration that they are not having the opportunities they see throughout the rest of the world. I had a long meeting yesterday with Secretary Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State. He and I are going to meet more on this. We're going to have other senators in both parties are going to meet with him and with President Biden. We're going to urge that steps be taken. In the short term, my message to the Cuban government is don't try to stifle these demonstrations. Listen to what they're saying, and then work with us. Find ways that we can meet some of the needs of these people. because they're legitimate. So many of these young people are well-educated. They want to start their own businesses. They want to have meetings and relations with other countries. We ought to be reaching out to that.
Nancy, thanks for your phone call. Let's talk to Sean, calling from Woodstock. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Generally, I want to say first and foremost, thank you to you and fellow Senator Bernie Sanders. I appreciate what you guys are doing and that you are holding the state of Vermont in the best interests. And I think that Bill Scott is a terrific governor for this state as well. The purpose of my phone call today was I heard you just say that you thought that Mitch McConnell and maybe Republican leaders might be coming around to the thought of the infrastructure bill. And I just want to say that I don't personally believe that. And the fact that there's two different infrastructure bills going on right now, though, you know, the one with that actually fixes bridges and roads and stuff like that, and then one that deals with the actual problems of the people, you know, well, I mean, not that the roads aren't actual problems, but, you know, the Medicare, the child care and everything like that. And I feel like they're going to pass the stuff that will immediately, you know, make them not seem so bad. But the other stuff, they're going to fearmonger and mislead people, I feel. And we're going to get one thing and not the other. And they're going to say, oh, it's their fault, blah, blah, blah.
Well, first off, I think that may well be what McConnell is thinking. And I feel the frustration of so many Republican leaders who would try to find a middle ground, Republican leaders of the past, in which he does not. But let's assume the first one passes. The second one, a lot of that can be done in reconciliation. I know Senator Sanders has been working very hard. He's had to give up some of the things he wanted, but others, more conservative members, have had to give up some of the things they wanted. And he may well have a package that if it got 50 votes, it would pass, of course, because the vice president would cast a deciding vote, and the House would accept it, and the president would sign it. I think that can happen. I actually think that will happen. And I'm wondering what happens then when McConnell sees that. Does he really want to go down in history as opposing all the things you just talked about, that we need to do in education, health care, improving the lives of all Americans, not just the privileged few?
Senator, when you look at that larger package, you've got some more moderate members of the Democratic caucus who have yet to announce their support for it. I'm thinking now of Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema. How confident are you that they're going to be with you when that final vote is taken?
Well, that's one of the reasons some of us are in Washington this weekend. There's a lot of negotiations going on. We'll see what comes of that. I know Senator Sanders has been working very hard, Senator Schumer and others. Basically, we have to stop and think, which is more important, an individual's political future or the future of the country? With me, the answer is very easy. And I remind people that they worry about casting this vote or that vote. I've cast more votes than I believe all but one or two people in the history of the country, 16,000 votes. Now, can I go back over that? Can somebody go back and say, oh, what were you thinking of vote number 11,410? My response would be, what the heck was 11,410? But you've got to stand up and vote for what you believe is right. And this is such a critical time for our country. We've come through a devastating pandemic. Fortunately, we've had leadership in Vermont that reacted well on it, but we see other parts of the country where they're almost ignoring this there as people die. We have a lot of problems in this country. Now, if we were at war, in a major like World War II, everybody would come together. Well, we have, in effect, a war on our health care, on our education system, on housing, on the ability for young people to have a future, and we ought to respond all together in that. If everybody has to give some, I'm willing to give some of my pet things, if others are, long as we get something that is predominantly good for the American people. And every single poll you take around the country has Republicans and Democrats agreeing with that.
Senator, we did get this email in from Deborah in Grand Isle. And Deborah wrote us, the GOP has made no secret of their intent to block as much of the Democratic agenda as they can. They are passing a myriad of state-based bills to suppress would-be Democratic minority-based voters. It's time to abolish the filibuster and pass the John Lewis Voting Act. What do you think? Would you support carving out an exemption of the filibuster in order to pass the Voting Act that's under consideration in Congress?
Understand that I wrote the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So obviously I want that to pass. Is that kind of voting rights legislation has always gotten bipartisan support in the past. I look at some of the predecessor legislation signed into law by President Nixon and Reagan and Bush. I mean, this is not a partisan thing. It usually gets an overwhelming vote. I'd like to bring it up. If that, if it does, I find it very hard that somebody would try to block it. I mean, it's had such strong bipartisan support. Now, what is happening in Texas and other states, this is a throwback to the Jim Crow era. It is the one thing that might trigger an exemption to the filibuster rule. But keep in mind, you make one exemption, others will follow, especially if Republicans come back in power. We were able to use it to protect women's rights, and we were able to use it when they tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We had a number of things that I had some of the same liberal groups that now say, get rid of the filibuster act, were sending me petitions saying, oh my God, keep the filibuster. It's the only way you're going to protect these things. You know, if the Republicans took whatever exemptions we make, if Republicans took control of the Senate in another year and a half, they would immediately expand those exemptions. The Voting Rights Act, of course, is something that has to be passed. I think most of S1 has to be passed. Americans should have the right to vote. When we saw the insurrection at the Capitol based on what Donald Trump said after he lost the presidential election by nearly 5 million votes, he started getting people riled up and saying, oh, it was fraud. We got to change all the laws. Read how those laws are changed in these states. They're changed so it's much harder to vote if you're in a minority area. It's much harder to vote for the elderly. It's much harder to vote for the poor. You know, you might not have the Ku Klux Klan out there marching, but in effect, that's what it's doing. So the politicizing the vote counting process, it's going to take more than just the John Lewis bill, proud as I am of having written it. It's going to take a reaction in this country that we have to have everybody be able to vote. Look how fortunate we are in Vermont. Jim Condos, our Secretary of State, in fact, my sister Mary sent me an article he had just written, I think, in the Times Argus, how we keep our voting open in Vermont. We make sure that everybody has an opportunity to vote. And that's the way it should be. That's why we have such honest voting. Look, as I pointed out at a hearing in judiciary on this a couple of days ago, Ted Cruz of Texas was going on and saying, oh, you want this just so one party will get elected, and it's terrible, and so on and so forth, as he always does, overstating and misstating what's in the law. I point out in Vermont, we have the most open, honest voting and available voting anywhere in the country. We elect a Republican governor, a Democratic lieutenant governor. It shows no party is kept out. People get to cast their votes.
Senator, I hear you saying it's really important, it's critical that Congress passes the Voting Rights Act, S1, as I think it's known. You feel very strongly that that needs to happen. You also look at ending the filibuster and say, if Democrats have some exemptions to the filibuster now, who knows what will happen if and when the Republicans come back in power in several years. So as you look at those two sides of the equation, when the time comes and it's push comes to shove, do you make an exemption to the filibuster in order to pass S1, the Voting Rights Act?
I don't know if the votes are there to do that. We're going to be having more discussions in our caucus next week. I intend to do everything possible to get the voting rights bill passed.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Rick, who is calling from South Burlington. Rick,
hello.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay, Senator and Bob?
Yes,
I hear you. How are you doing, Bob?
Okay. I wanted to make two points and then ask a question. The first relates to the filibuster discussion about how, you know, the Democrats can use it to block legislation progress on things like abortion, or I say progress from the Republican side if they get their way. But there's a flip to that. And all kinds of academic experts all over the country are pointing out, and polls are showing that Americans agree, that's the reason we have not been passing legislation on all kinds of issues that the American public, in majorities of both sides of us, ideologically, across the spectrum, agree on. Climate change, health care, all kinds of things are being blocked by this higher standard that each side is imposing. That's why Mitch McConnell can try and get nothing done, so he can run on the fact that Democrats can't get anything done. And that isn't serving American citizens. Passing S1 and adjusting the filibuster to simply, even if it's a majority, allows legislation to actually be enabled. And if the American public doesn't like it, we get a chance in the next election to weigh in. And that's really important. And the only
okay, Rick, have you got a question here too, Rick?
Well, yes. My question is, would you be willing to speak out much more than you have over the time since you first went to office? Because this has all developed since the mid-1970s, and it's gotten more and more dysfunctional. Would you be willing to explain the studies that are out there to the American people that show why the Senate is so dysfunctional and Congress is being dysfunctional and why so many
Let me cut to the chase. For one, I've spoken out about this hundreds of times on the floor of the Senate. I did just in the past couple of weeks. I'm sorry if you haven't heard me each time I've spoken, but I'd also point out that it's more than just talking about it, it's doing it. Let me give you an example. When Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court Justice, died, and I remember hearing from people what difference it makes who's in charge of the Senate. Well, there was a year till the next election, and President Obama nominated a person who would easily get 80 votes. The majority leader is the one that could bring up the vote or not. That was Mitch McConnell. He never brought it up. He said, we're within a year of an election. We cannot have this vote. And so the seat remained empty for a year. He then rushed through in the remaining weeks of President Trump's term in office, a conservative Supreme Court justice, violated every rule, rules of quorum and everything else, and did it because he was the majority leader. And I think of some of the Senate races that we had had the 2 years before, which would have changed the majority in the Senate. We had some very good candidates that didn't make it because people said, well, they're really pretty good, but they're not perfect on every single spot, so I can't vote for them. And that just empowered Mitch McConnell. It is one thing to talk in the abstract. It's another thing to be real. If I thought we could get the, had a procedure, we get the votes to get the Voting Rights Act, something that normally passes overwhelmingly, or ask one or any of the others through, of course I'd support that. But it is one thing to talk about it and say, oh, yeah, all you have to do is this, that, or the other thing. Be down here and try to do it. I'll give you an example of how this works. During the last budget, we were trying to figure out what we would do for relief to the states when the first major COVID relief. And my staff and I were working evenings, weekends, over and over again during that time. None of this is in the press. I remember a couple of people say, gosh, it'd be nice if you came by this parade or whatever it is. What were we doing? We got over $1 billion extra for the state of Vermont by working in a way. And part of that was the time when I was in the minority party. And we got that, getting more money than per capita in 48 other states to help us on COVID relief. And it's one of the reasons why we are the safest nation, safest state in the nation. I say that because I've had so many people say, well, on the right or the left, just endorse this one thing and it's all done. It doesn't work that way. If you want to bring up, and we will bring up these bills, if they are still blocked, then there may be the support to change the filibuster. You change it in one part, you know, and within a year or so, it'll be changed in all parts. But you're going to have to actually have a bill before us, not just talking in the abstract.
Senator, we have a very popular and award-winning podcast here at VPR known as Brave Little State that answers questions selected by the audience. And right now, the show is working on a listener question about the F-35 fighter jets now based at the Burlington International Airport with the Vermont Air National Guard. Listener Bobby Arnell of Winooski asked how this jet came to be based in Vermont, and he wanted to know if he could speak to you directly. This is what he would ask. Here he is.
I'd really like to know what that process looked like and what led to that decision, and if he was aware of how greatly this would affect members of Winooski or how loud they would be, and if he would still make that decision now, knowing how loud they are and all of the feedback that he's gotten from members of Winooski and also Burlington as well.
So, Senator Leahy, if you knew then what you knew now, was Bobby Arnell's question, would you have supported those F-35s back then?
Well, as you know, Senator Sanders, Congressman Welch, myself, and Governor Scott all supported the F-35. The decision was made during the final decision during the Trump administration. And I think the fact that everybody here supported it. And, of course, the final decision was that of the Air Force. That's how it was made. Now, I've been there. I've heard them. They are louder than the F-16s. That's a different frequency. Just like the planes that carry UPS and all those other type planes, cargo planes, are much noisier than some of our passenger planes. The F-16 was noisy if it was using its a turbocharger for takeoff. But because I have heard this is being noisier, I've been working to get money, FAA funding, to help with mitigation. For example, we secured funding for the Chamberlain School in South Burlington. We're getting funding for communities to help. Winooski is one. I know when I was, I never heard a jet when I was in my first year at St. Michael's College until one of the jets, which are much louder than the F-35, took off from the Burlington airport. And I remember how shocked I was hearing the noise. Having grown up in Montpelier, we didn't hear any jets. This noise, I think people do have legitimate concerns about noise. I know Senator Sanders, Congressman Welch, I and the governor are doing everything possible, working with the Guard to do that. But we do have an Air National Guard. And I remember when Senator Sanders asked the Secretary of the Air Force, if we don't have the F-35, do you have any other plane we could have? She said emphatically, no. And he said, what we all agreed to, we should have then the F-35. We should be very, very proud of the Air and Army National Guard that we have in Vermont. I'm extremely proud of them. They've usually been rated among the best in the country. They were the ones sent to protect our skies after 9/11 and did that around the clock for well over a month. And the sound is a reality, but the mitigations can be improved. There are things that can be done, and we'll do it.
So as you mentioned, you've heard these jets. So do you understand why some people on the flight path of these F-35s feel uncomfortable with the noise level?
I think I do, just as they feel uncomfortable with the noise level of a lot of planes on that flight path, especially cargo planes. And one person recently came to talk with me, and I tried to listen to anybody who did want to talk with me, and said they had recently bought a house in South Burlington, and the noise of the airplanes or something, couldn't that airport be moved to somewhere like the Northeast Kingdom, where it'd be a far less population? I told him that probably would not happen, and then I realized he was serious. I thought at first he was joking. I said, let's work at ways to mitigate the sound, because you're going to have other airplanes. We recently had some F-16s were back there, taken off with afterburners. They're from another air base. We're going to constantly have this, just as we have our F-35s have been out in another state practicing with them. The question is, do we want an Air Guard? Do we want a National Guard? I do. But then I also want all the mitigations we can in the way they do the flying, doing it, and I am pleased that they do it without afterburners. And, you know, my office, when I'm there, I hear them, and it is, can be a momentary distraction. It really comes down to, if you're going to have an Air National Guard, you're going to have them. If you want to get rid of the Air National Guard, then you won't have them. You have to weigh those benefits.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mark, who is calling from South Hero. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First of all, thank you to you, Senator Lee, for steadfastly upholding our democracy and our democratic processes through 4 years of assault. Very proud of you and having you as our senator. And second, related to the F-35s, I hear you saying you support mitigation efforts. As I understand it, mitigation works if you're inside, your windows are closed, everything's tight. In reality, kids play outside on playgrounds, people take walks, they ride on the bike path. And it's a traumatic experience. It's not just a momentary disturbance. It's an assault on your whole being when those planes go over. And I think of the people, I live near the lake in South Hero, so I can hear them, thankfully not as loudly as people who are closer in. But there are disturbances even here, and I can only imagine what it's like day in and day out to try to plan your day so that you're undercover when they go over. It's like living in a war zone, and that I wish there were a way not to subject so much of our population to that, from little children to people who've had PTSD to elders who are in frail condition.
Would you suggest we do away with the Air National Guard? If that is the only choice they have, would you suggest we do away with them? I don't mean that facetiously. I'm asking.
Well, it does touch on another point, which is that I guess I would say yes, in the best of all worlds, I'd like to live in a country more like Costa Rica, where we don't have to have so much spending on weapons, and we can actually spend things on the things that benefit people day to day. And I know that's going to raise a lot of hackles, because people say, well, the only way we have the country we have is because we've got a massive military that keeps us safe. I guess I would argue maybe we'd have fewer people having to flee their countries and come to our country. I think we should have open borders, but I think we should welcome people legally, is what I'm trying to say. But maybe if we were helping people in their own countries have the things that they need, they wouldn't undertake monumental efforts to leave their homeland, which they probably don't really want to do in the first place. So I guess it's a weighing of where are our priorities, and is there a way to make peace without practicing war?
Nothing I would like more for not only for my generation, but for my grandchildren's generation, to think we're at a time we don't have to face war. Unfortunately, history teaches us otherwise. What I would hope is that we'd not be involved in unnecessary wars as we have. As you know, I voted against the war in Iraq when I was first elected to the Senate. You may find this hard to believe, but at that time, the majority in Vermont favored the war in Vietnam. No Vermonter in Congress had ever voted to stop the war in Vietnam. In April of 1975, by a one-vote margin in the Armed Services Committee, the war in Vietnam was stopped. I was the newest member. It was my vote. I remember the editor of one of our major newspapers saying, after that, I would never be reelected because I voted to end the war in Vietnam. Now I'm proud of the fact that we used the Leahy War Victims Fund to help people who were injured by landmines, Agent Orange, and everything else in Vietnam, as well as using the Leahy War Victims Fund to help our own people who have been injured by that. And there are steps that can be taken. Wars do not have to happen. I would much rather see us investing in other countries and helping people. I think what Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said if you want to cut our foreign aid that's helping these countries, then buy me more bullets because I'm going to need it.
Senator, we're almost out of time, but we did get a call from Dave in St. Johnsbury. Let me just paraphrase what Dave asked us. He's looking at the situation in Afghanistan and the nearly 20-year involvement of this country over there as it's winding down. And Dave is concerned of the thousands of people who are still in Afghanistan, primarily translators who assisted the U.S. military trying to get them out of the country. Is the Biden administration doing enough to make that happen?
The Biden administration is already taking steps. And during the past several weeks, I have met with dozens of Republicans and Democratic senators to get support for my bill that will pay to get these translators out of Afghanistan. If we don't, we're going to see them being just executed by the Taliban. We have to get them out. I've talked with President Biden about this, Secretary Blinken. They're strongly supportive of this. I will get the money to get it done.
Well, as chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Senator Patrick Leahy finds himself in the middle of a lot of debates down in Washington. Senator, we really appreciate you taking the time today to speak with us on a wide range of issues.
Well, thank you, Bob, and I look forward to seeing you in Montpelier or at your new enlarged place in Colchester. But I especially love it when I'm walking down the streets of Montpelier and we run into each other and settle all the problems of the world in a space of 4 or 5 minutes.